It's June 1988, and in eastern France, Airbus Senior Vice President Bernard Ziegler looks Captain Michel Asseline up and down. The two men are in a meeting room in Mulhouse Airport. They're still absorbing the shock of how yesterday's A320 airshow stunt went tragically wrong. Miraculously, just three of the 130 passengers died in the crash after the jet missed the runway, slammed into a forest, and burst into flames. Now, investigators must determine whether the crash was due to human error or mechanical failure. Ziegler gently prompts Captain Asseline for an explanation.
Michel, what happened?
The shaken Air France pilot stares at the man who masterminded the A320's computerized fly-by-wire flight control system.
I tried to climb to avoid the trees, but the plane blocked me. The computers caused the crash.
Ziegler says nothing. He's seen the footage on TV. It looks to him like the A320 worked just as it should, and Asseline mistimed his stunt. The pilot's eyes widen at Ziegler's silence and the implied blame.
Bernard, you know what a good pilot I am. It's impossible. I cannot have caused that crash.
Ziegler doesn't believe him. The media is asking whether computer co-pilots can be trusted. But for Ziegler, that's the wrong question. For him, the question is, can human pilots be trusted? Pilots are people. People get lazy. They get distracted. They can be brilliant one day and competent the next. They also get cocky. And Ziegler wonders if that's what's happened with Asseline.
Michel, let's just see what the investigators say.
And what those investigators find will be critical to Airbus. So far, airlines have not canceled orders for the A320s. After all, they want their A320s to ferry people from A to B rather than perform flashy stunts at air shows. But Ziegler also knows that if his fly-by-wire technology is at fault, Airbus might never recover. And Boeing is quietly circling overhead. It smells blood.
Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's vice chair and president, Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though many of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill talk about how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can check out this episode and a whole lot more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.
From Wondery, I'm David Brown, and this is Business Wars. On our last episode, Airbus took aim at Boeing's best-selling 737 with the A320, a single-aisle jet equipped with revolutionary fly-by-wire computer technology. But after an airshow crash in eastern France, the safety of Airbus's computerized airliner is in doubt. And while Airbus waits for the crash investigation to finish, Boeing is searching for a way to stop the European Challenger's advance. This is Episode 4, An Unholy Alliance. It's 1988, and in United Airlines Chicago headquarters,
A Boeing vice president in a red sweater and chinos is under pressure. He's Phil Condit, and despite his casual attire, he's the front runner to be the aircraft maker's next CEO. Condit is visiting United to present a plan that's vital to Boeing's future, not to mention his own. Condit smiles as he gives United Vice President Jim Guyette the lowdown. We know airlines are increasing the number of longer routes, but we also know passenger numbers on these routes aren't high enough yet to justify a 747. So we're designing a new jet. Guyette knows Airbus is pushing a new jet called the A330 as its solution to this sub-jumbo gap in the market. But he's eager to hear Boeing's alternative. As Guyette talks about what's in the pipeline, Condit's smile grows. A double-decker 767 with extra range and more seats. Guyette's interest vanishes.
That's it? That's what you've got?
Phil, Airbus is developing the A330 specifically for these longer routes. You're offering some retrofitted decade-old plane. You need a brand new jet. Anything else won't cut it. Condit tries to hide his disappointment. Making a brand new plane will cost billions more than another 767 derivative.
Okay, Jim, what do you want? I can list features, but what I really want is to be involved in the preliminary design, not just consulted. Involved!
It's an unusual request, to be sure. No aircraft manufacturers ever allowed an airline to help design a new jet. No doubt Boeing engineers will object. But it might be the only way to hook United.
Okay, but we need other airlines involved, too. We can't risk creating a jet only United wants.
Guyette nods.
I understand, and to be clear, I'm not promising to buy what you come up with. It's just that I want a plane as close to our ideal as possible.
In the months that follow, Boeing gets United and seven other airlines to help it design a new jet, the 777. Like the A330, the 777 will be an economic medium-range twin jet. But it'll also have a wider fuselage to allow more seats than the A330 and incorporate the fly-by-wire technology pioneered by Airbus. But Boeing's taking a different approach to computerized flight. While Airbus's computers have final say on what pilots can do, Boeing will let pilots override the system. But just as work on the 777 begins, the initial findings on the role Airbus's fly-by-wire systems played in the Malaysia air show crash arrives. It's June 1989, and in a judge's chambers in eastern France, Michel Asselin fidgets nervously in his seat. Across the desk from the former Air France captain is the judge investigating the crash of the A320 flown by Asselin.
Mr. Asselin, my role is to gather evidence and decide whether there is a case to prosecute. If so, I indict those I think responsible, and the case goes to a full hearing. Do you understand?
Yes.
Good. I summoned you today because I believe there is enough evidence to indict you on charges of involuntary homicide and injury.
But I am innocent. It is the aircraft's fault. The engines didn't respond fast enough.
Mr. Asselin, understand, please, this is a charge, not a conviction. You will get to defend yourself at the trial.
The final verdict is years away, but when it does come, Asselin will be found guilty. Man, not machine, caused that crash. Worries about Airbus's fly-by-wire systems fade fast. Soon, Airbus is taking market share from Boeing and McDonnell Douglas. And with the A330 and its bigger sister, the A340, in the pipeline, Airbus now has a rival product to match every Boeing jet. Except one, Boeing 747 Jumbo Jet. It took a decade for the world's biggest commercial jet to break even, but now it's a cash cow. The 747 comes with a $200 million price tag, and with no alternative on the market, Boeing doesn't offer discounts either. Every 747 sold nets Boeing $30 million of pure profit. Profit it can use to help defend the 737 from the A320. The 747 is the biggest predator in the sky, and that's why Airbus has set its sights on tackling Boeing's most iconic jet. It's summer 1990, and in the Airbus conference room in Toulouse, France, Jean Pearson lights another white-tipped Gitane cigarette. The portly Airbus CEO takes a long drag and thinks about the presentation he and his senior team just heard. The presentation sketching out what it would take to make a super jumbo, a 600-seat behemoth that would dwarf the 747. But the cost is equally huge. Airbus needs $10 billion to make it. But with the A320 selling fast, Europe's governments no longer feel the need to throw that kind of money at Airbus. Airbus's finance chief looks worried.
The market can't support two super jumbos. We'll lose billions and delay the day when we become profitable by years.
Pearson waves his hand dismissively.
But it will reduce Boeing's profits from the 747, leaving them with less money to fight us in other parts of the market. The A340 is already attracting airlines that feel like the 747 is too risky. A super jumbo will attract the customers that want the biggest plane possible. With a super jumbo, we can attack the 747 from above and from below. We can squeeze it like a lemon.
The finance chief protests.
But, John, the cost!
Pearson throws his hands into the air.
Then let's find partners and share the risk. Maybe the Japanese, huh? They want to be more than Boeing subcontractors, surely. Let's see who's interested. And let's go from there.
But the partner Airbus finds is the one it least expects. It's September 1992, and the spectators at the Farnborough Air Show in England are getting drenched. As spectators seek shelter, Pearson weaves through the crowds to a small, out-of-the-way tent plastered with Boeing logos. There's an employees-only sign on the door. The French Airbus boss looks around to make sure no one sees him, and then slips inside. Waiting for him is a bald man in a dark suit, Boeing Vice President John Hayhurst. Hayhurst gets straight to business.
Thanks for accepting my invitation, John. I'll be quick. We're looking at making Super Jumbo, and we know you are too, but the market's too small for both of us. One of us, maybe both of us, will lose a hell of a lot of money. So you want us to walk away? Actually, I've got a different idea. We unite. We do a joint study of the design and market potential. We split the cost, and if it goes well, maybe do a joint venture to build it.
Pearson can barely believe his ears. An alliance with Boeing? He never imagined that. But maybe it could work. If nothing else, it'll save Airbus hundreds of millions in preliminary R&D costs. And if they join forces to make and sell a super jumbo, it would shatter the 747 stranglehold on high-capacity jets.
We'd need to negotiate how the study would be funded and conducted.
Hayhurst smiles.
Of course, but I want to negotiate with one person. I don't want to have to deal with representatives from every Airbus consortium partner. I'm thinking Jürgen Schrempp.
Pearson shrugs. Schrempp runs Deutsche Airbus, the Daimler-Benz division behind the German Airbus factories. Deutsche Airbus also owns a 38% stake in the Airbus consortium.
Sure, provided Jürgen wants to do it.
But Hayhurst already knows Schrempp will do it. And that's because he's been having secret meetings with the ambitious Deutsche Airbus chief. And he's convinced Schrempp that this Boeing-Airbus alliance will propel him to the very top of Daimler-Benz. It's a few months later, and in a hotel meeting room in Seville, Spain, Schrempp is briefing the Airbus board on his talks with Boeing.
The vibe is positive, but Boeing wants Deutsche Airbus to lead our part of the Super Jumbo study.
Pearson and the rest of the Airbus board look shocked. Everyone assumed Airbus would handle that. A Spanish board member interjects.
Airbus should do this. They represent the whole consortium.
Schrempp glares at the Spanish executive.
Boeing doesn't want that. They won't work with Airbus itself. Also, this is a good opportunity for Deutsche Airbus. If you refuse, We will form an alliance with Boeing anyway.
Jaws drop. Shrimp's actually threatening to rip apart the Airbus consortium over this. No one dares call his bluff, because Airbus can't survive without its German partner. Pearson breaks the silence.
I don't object, but we must all ask ourselves this question. Why do the Americans who own half the market want to share their jumbo jet monopoly with us, the guys who have 20% of the market?
The question goes unanswered, but it hangs in the room like a bad smell. Pearson's rueing the day he agreed to this alliance. He's beginning to suspect Boeing is using it as an opportunity to sow division within the Airbus consortium and delay Airbus from making its own super jumbo project. And if that's Boeing's plan, it's working.
You know, Audible has a brand new collection of exclusive thrillers. Every move is made more exciting by captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. I just downloaded The Grand Opening by Carl Weber. It's a mystery about a family business in a small southern town, and there are secrets around every turn. You know, when I'm listening, the time just disappears, getting completely immersed in the story and the performances. And as an Audible member, you get to keep one title a month from their entire catalog, including bestsellers and new releases. So come on, listen along. New members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Head on over to audible.com/BW or just text BW to 500-500. That's audible.com/BW or text BW to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days. We get support from Court. You know, the way people work is changing and the workplace itself needs to change too. But what if flexibility wasn't just an option? With Court's flexible furniture solutions, you can create agile work environments that become your team's greatest advantage. Save capital with swing spaces, attract top talent with collaborative environments, and create connected spaces that employees will love. Flexibility is the future, and Court Furniture Rental helps you embrace it. Learn more at Court, that's CORT.com/office.
It's April 1995 in Munich, Germany. The Airbus executives are in the bar of the Four Seasons Hotel, and the night's still young. A few hours ago, they held a dinner with their Boeing counterparts to mark the end of their super jumbo alliance. After 3 years of uneasy cooperation, they've hit an impasse. Boeing feels the market is too small to justify the $15 billion investment the super jumbo needs. Airbus disagrees. So they've ended their alliance, and now, with Boeing's team already off to bed, the well-lubricated Airbus crew is dreaming big. Airbus CEO Jean Pearson pours another glass of white wine and grins.
Maybe we put seats on the wings.
Another executive signals to the waitress for another round and offers a pie-in-the-sky idea of his own.
Now, make a triple-decker plane. It could have shops and casinos. Hairdressers.
The wild ideas keep flowing, as do the drinks. They're still talking at sunrise, and when they finally crash into their beds, they no longer care about the risks. Airbus is going to build the biggest passenger jet this world has ever seen, no matter the cost. But back in Seattle, Boeing's about to resume hostilities. It's 1996, and in his office in Boeing headquarters, the company's new CEO, Phil Condit, has got a plan to put Airbus on the defensive. To do that, he wants to transform Boeing from an engineering-led business to one driven by sales. And to win sales, he needs to go on the offensive against Airbus. And that's why he's called Ron Woodard into his office. Condit's just put Woodard in charge of Boeing's commercial aircraft division, and he's looking to him to come up with a winning strike against Airbus. Condit takes a swig from his coffee cup and looks at Woodard.
So, Ron, how's this strategy of yours work? We outproduce and undercut Airbus. If we make planes faster and cheaper than they can, and we can, they're toast.
Imagine a world where airlines can order a plane and get it delivered as quickly as you or me could get a new car. Condit knows the analogy is off, but he gets the logic. Airbus is a consortium. It can't just ramp up production. It needs to get all its partner manufacturers from various countries to agree first. That kind of bureaucracy can work in Boeing's favor. A price war would also create a headwind for Airbus. The European governments that bankrolled Airbus are now pressing the consortium to deliver profits. The days when Airbus could undercut Boeing without feeling the pinch are ending. A sly smile grows on Condit's face. He likes this plan. Soon after, Boeing's blitz begins. Armed with big discounts and aggressive delivery timetables, Boeing rolls Airbus. After 20 years of rising market share, Airbus stops gaining altitude. To win customers now, it'll have to make some painful concessions. It's 1997, and in U.S. Airways' head office in Arlington, Virginia, Airbus CEO Jean Pearson's feeling pretty good. He spent months working out a 400-plane deal with the airline. It's an agreement worth between $5 and $18 billion, depending on options. But plenty big enough to make up for all the orders lost to Boeing. And now, Pearson's in the office of U.S. Airways CEO Steve Wolf, convinced he's a handshake away from clinching this mega contract.
So, we're good?
Actually, no. I've got more asks. Pearson's heart sinks. He thought the haggling was over. Wolf issues his first demand.
I want the deliveries to start a year earlier.
Steve, that's impossible. How about we bring the schedule forward 2 months?
3 months.
All right. What else?
I want 5% off the price.
Pearson locks eyes with Wolf and slowly stands up. Then, the Airbus CEO unbuckles his belt and lets his pants drop.
Well, see? I've got no more to give.
All right. Jeez, Pearson. Get your pants back on. Okay, the deal's yours. Just pull those damn pants back up.
But while Pearson's dignity is taking a hit, Boeing's discovering the downside of success. It's September 1997, and in Boeing's plant in Renton, Washington, workers in white overalls and face masks are spray-painting the latest 737 to roll off the assembly line. But then, an announcement comes over the public address system.
Please gather on the factory floor for an urgent meeting. Urgent meeting now on the factory floor.
The workers arrive to find their stressed-out supervisor pacing up and down.
There's been another, screw-up. The wiring's not finished on the jet you're painting. It's got to go back to wiring right away. We'll have to start over when it returns.
One worker explodes.
What? This again? What the hell is going on around here?
Every worker is wondering the same thing. And that's because Boeing's new aggressive sales strategy has worked. In fact, it's worked so well that an avalanche of orders is overwhelming the company. Suppliers are struggling to produce parts fast enough. Half-built jets are filling the tarmac outside the assembly lines. Workers are pulling triple shifts and still can't dent the backlog. And in all this chaos, planes are being sent to the wrong part of the production line. But instead of getting on top of the situation quickly, Boeing's top brass has let the problems fester. They're too busy trying to nail the $13 billion takeover of McDonnell Douglas that'll make Boeing the world's biggest military plane maker. And they don't want to make any decisions that could endanger that acquisition. Finally, in October 1997, with the McDonnell Douglas buyout done, CEO Phil Condit acts. He shuts down the 737 and 747 production lines for 3 weeks to restore order. But the damage is already done. The manufacturing meltdown forces Condit to announce a $2.6 billion write-off. The company's stock price plunges, wiping out $4.3 billion of Boeing's value. Enraged stockholders sue,
Airlines demand millions in late delivery penalties. Boeing's reputation as the king of American manufacturing is shattered. Boeing's push for more orders has backfired badly and given Airbus one more shot at becoming Top Gun. On the next episode, scandal engulfs Boeing, Airbus's super jumbo hits severe turbulence, and the U.S. and EU get in the ring.
Hey, Prime members, you can binge every episode of Business Wars ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
From Wondery, this is Business Wars. Quick note about the conversations you've been hearing. We can't know exactly what was said, but this dialogue is based on our best research. I'm your host, David Brown. Tristan Donovan wrote this story. Karen Lowe is our senior producer and editor. Produced by Emily Frost. Sound designed by Kyle Randall. Our executive producers are Jenny Lauer Beckman and Marshall Louie. Created by Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.